Welcome to the Readings Podcast, a production from Melbourne's leading independent bookstore, Readings. In today's episode, a conversation with Michaela Saunders, author of a new collection of short stories, Always Will Be. Saunders is a Koori, Guri and Lebanese writer, teacher and researcher, and the editor of This All Come Back Now, the Auroralis Award-winning anthology of First Nations speculative fiction. Saunders has been awarded numerous prizes for their writing, including the 2022 David Unaipon Award. And this most recent work draws from stories written from the past couple of years into a collection that poses the question, what might country, community, and culture look like in the Tweed Valley if Guris reasserted their sovereignty? I began our conversation by asking Saunders to reflect upon the writing of this book and its primary setting, the Tweed Valley, and what that in turn means in the context of this collection. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I chose to write this book because I grew up in the Tweed and the Tweed Guri community and my Aboriginal community. And even though I kind of moved away for work, I've always come back, moved away, come back, moved away. I've always remained really, you know, involved in my community. I love my community. And the reason I started thinking about this book, really back in 2016 is when I started thinking about writing it. I'd been reading a lot of speculative fiction, particularly Australian futurism. That's when Mad Max Fury Road came out around that time. And I'd been really thinking about why there weren't many Aboriginal people in these futures. You know, there's a few Aboriginal written works, texts that have Aboriginal people in the future, but some of them I found pretty unsatisfying. So I started thinking about this project where I wanted to write my own community into the future and not just as like stage sets or props or token blackfellas. I wanted all these stories to center thriving Aboriginal communities. So that's what I set out to do with this project. I enrolled in a creative writing course at Sydney Uni in 2017. I'd never written fiction before or anything like that. And so it was a pretty steep learning curve. But from 2017 to 2021, when I handed my thesis in, I wrote most of the stories in this book. And it deals with climate change, different political realities, different population dynamics. And in each story, I also wanted to explore different versions of Guri sovereignty, because that was another thing I found sorely missing in a lot of Australian futurism.
I think it's an important contribution to make. And I do find it interesting that a lot of these stories are set in a near future, where there's not too much different from that path we seem to be heading. The reality and the history carries forth with the settler colony running along as it has, but it runs up against reality, and many of these stories explore this. In different situations, the characters that populate these stories, or embody in some cases, they have to come up against these realities. Some of these feel utopian, and some feel quite dystopian. It seems like a lot of writers tend towards the latter, more so than the former. What is your approach to this?
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mentioned earlier that I read, you know, quite a few Aboriginal or Indigenous futurism stories, and I found them quite unsatisfying. And that's the reason a lot of them are quite pessimistic. And I get it. I totally get it. I mean, we're already living in a dystopia, but my goal for this book was that it be read by people in my community, and a lot of people in my community are young people, and I wanted them to see some good in our future. So no matter what happens, whether the seas rise and reclaim the land, or whether the planet freezes, or whatever happens, we'll still be here. We're not going anywhere. We'll always be together. And that was the point of the stories. So in one of the stories, there's a bit of a fascist Guri government takeover. You know, I find that totally unbelievable, but it is very dystopian. It's a very grim story, but I've heard all my life, you know, being involved in different political movements, you know, young blackfellas who want to take up arms, and I get it, you know, but I wanted to think about what that would really mean, you know, how would that really kind of come about? So all of these stories are really thought experiments, you know. What would happen if blackfellas took over in a violent way? What would that look like? That's that story. Another story where the oceans have risen, and instead of moving inland to encroach on other people, the GRU community decided we're not going anywhere, we're staying put, and they found creative ways to live on the water. So that's another thought experiment. What would happen if the waters rose? How would we live then? And each of the stories asks a different question, and it comes up with a different answer. And some of those answers are pretty grim, but I think no matter what I wanted to show, that it doesn't matter what happens or how bad it gets or how good it gets, we'll always be here. We'll always be. And that's, you know, where the title comes from. It's a always will be is half of the land rights slogan, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. And I acknowledge that it comes from Uncle Jim Bates, who is a Barkindji land rights activist. And yeah, I wanted to really impress in every story that it doesn't matter what happened, whether it's a near future, you know, a few years away, or hundreds of years down the track, we're always going to be here.
And that comes through very strongly, I think. Are there certain characters in the book where you yourself identify with their projections, their experiences, their aspirations for a future? Because there are difficulties and contradictions that these characters have to negotiate as well.
Well, this was actually a way of me grappling with my anxiety and my depression about thinking about the future. You know, I think the climate emergency is here. It's now. Obviously, it's felt unevenly across the globe, depending on what community you belong to and what kind of resources you have access to, what your government will or won't do for you. So researching and thinking about these stories was actually led me to some pretty dark places. You know, I felt extremely grim about the future. But as always, as I always do, I go back to my community, I talk to people, I remember all the stories I was ever told. My old people, our old people, went through some horrific things. It's a wonder any of us survived, really. They did everything that they could to try and breed us out, if not kill us outright. And the fact that we survived is, to me, enough hope. That's enough. That's all I need. And so even though I could feel pretty grim and, you know, horrified at what might come, because I'm a writer, I have a great imagination, you know, and that's a double-edged sword. I can imagine amazing things, but I can always imagine the worst things. So, right. So exercising that muscle of my imagination, I didn't want to just think about all the worst stuff. I also wanted to think about what would people in my community do. I'm not writing for other people. I'm not writing for other communities. I'm not speaking for my community. I'm just one person in a huge community that belongs to the Tweed, you know, across space and time. I'm just writing my own fears and my own hopes, you know. So, yeah, you mentioned that, you know, there's all these different characters who kind of embody different ways of thinking about the future, different sovereignty. I'm in all of these characters, really. It's a way for me to try on these mindsets or try in these situations and think about what might happen. You know, there's some really despicable characters in here, I think, but there's also some really sweet ones, and I think I'm a little bit of both. So hopefully that answers your question.
I think that's a pretty honest, reflective answer. Though from our conversation so far, I wouldn't jump to characterize you as a despicable person.
I don't think I'm a wholly a good guy, but I don't think I'm wholly a bad guy either. I think I'm just human, and I try and write characters who are human, you know, like all of us. We have things we need to work on, things we need to reckon with. To me, that's kind of not the most important thing in writing these stories from a craft perspective. It was mostly about, yeah, what kind of worlds might be coming to meet us in 5, 10, 100 years, and what kind of characters might live in those worlds, and how might they interact with those worlds, and what might their stories be. So it wasn't a matter of who's good, who's bad. It's you know, what are they doing? What are they reckoning with, and how do they grapple with these problems?
I understand.
One of the stories I wrote long before COVID and the housing crisis, the story's already here. I wasn't prescient enough to implicate Airbnb in these housing crisis on the coast, but, you know, in the Tweed, where a lot of my family and my community still are, it's impossible to live there if you're a working class person. It's impossible to get a rental. During COVID, all the rich people kind of flew in and bought everything up, and turn everything into Airbnbs, and it's just impossible to get long-term affordable rentals anymore. And one of my stories deals with this, and I thought this was, I was writing a terrifying future, but I'm writing a really horrible present, actually. It doesn't give me any glee to talk about that, but that's just how it is, yeah.
It is remarkable that something so ubiquitous across the country is so really explored, like in the way that you have in this book. One scenario that you bring up, which I hadn't considered before, was a future where Surfers Paradise and then the Gold Coast more broadly keeps on expanding to become the biggest city in Australia, a sprawling metropolis to dwarf the current Big Two. All I could keep on thinking about was how bizarre and strange the aesthetics of that city would be. Where did the idea come from to project that terrifying image?
One day, I was back home. I'd gone back home for a funeral, and I was swimming at the beach, and I looked up the coast. I was swimming at Tugan, I think, or Currumbin. I looked up the coast. I saw Surfers Paradise glittering up on the coastline. It was sunset, so, you know, all those buildings were catching light. It just looked like this kind of mythical Atlantis. And I looked down the coast and I just saw these cranes and all these new high-rises going up. And then I looked to the right down the coast and I saw a few cranes on the south side too. And I thought, oh my God, this is really happening, isn't it? And I just, in my imagination, I imagined all these buildings just coming up and coming up and then just creeping over. I talk about it in the story. It's called No Country for Old Women. One of the biggest reasons why the Tweed and Fingal in particular has not been turned into a rich man's playground is because our community have always fought against it. They've always put their foot down. In the 80s, rich people wanted to turn Fingal into like a resort and a golf club, and the community said no. Mind you, all the rates have gone up, so a lot of locals can't afford to live there anymore, but it's still green. It's not a rich man's playground. But with the Gold Coast, you've got different interests, you've got different politicians, and so they've been able to just develop without, you know, building proper infrastructure. Now in Tweed, I imagine what would happen if our community didn't fight for that. You know, it would just turn into another Gold Coast. I mean, it happens everywhere. That's beautiful. They want to buy it and they want to make more money off it. And so, yeah, I just imagined, you know, why wouldn't the Northern Rivers turn into that? You've got Byron Bay down the road. You've got all these beautiful beaches. It's a really horrible idea, but it's actually kind of happening. So it's the now.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And perhaps to pivot a little to the style of your writing, I think you inhabit a pretty neat, identifiable style across these works, despite them coming from different years of production and focusing on different things. And there's one story that's quite different, though, in its construction, the one titled Our Future in the Stars. I'd love to know about how you went about writing that one and presenting it.
Yeah, well, when I first wrote that, that was just a straight story, but it just wasn't quite working. It was such a dialogue-heavy story. I thought, why not just make it dialogue? There are a couple little interludes where we're shown what's happening with the two men and what they're doing, but it's the story is what their relationship and how they're talking to each other and the change that they're on, the, you know, their history, and not just their personal history, but their family, community history. It's all in there. Before writing this, I hadn't written fiction before. My first story I ever wrote is in here, Terra Nora. The second story I ever wrote is in here, River Story. The third story I ever wrote in here, A Guided Meditation, is in here. These are the first 17 stories I ever wrote. And because I was having a lot of fun learning about characterization, imagery, subtext, metatext, context, all the fun things that you nerd out about when you're starting out with creative writing, I wanted to experiment. Not, you know, it's not, I wouldn't call it an experimental collection, but there are different perspectives and voices in here that I wanted to experiment with. And with Our Future in the Stars, which is the story you mentioned earlier, when I first wrote it, as I said, it was just a normal story, you know, this man did that, this man did that. But over time, over editing, multiple edits, mind you, I have edited the bejesus out of this thing. The very first manuscript is very, very different. Your brain switches into editing mode when you look at your old writing and you go, oh, no, that needs to change. And that's a good thing, cringing at your old writing. It's a really good thing. You're able to turn it into that vision you had for it. The first version of Our Future in the Stars was so heavy-handed. I remember showing it to my publisher, Aviva. She'd asked to read some more of my work, and that was such an early draft, and I sent it to her. And I remember she said, oh, it's really heavy-handed. It's not like your other stuff. That's how I write. I write really, really, really bad first drafts. I just want to get the idea down. And then over time, over multiple edits, I just keep feeding it through, massaging it into elegance. And yeah, oftentimes the form changes or the way of telling it changes. And that's definitely what happened with Our Future in the Stars. I decided I wanted it to be mostly dialogue. And in that way, instead of like setting the scene for the reader through a narrator, the reader can come to that with their own, you know, idea of what's happening around, and they can imagine that. And, you know, one interesting thing I noticed about when I started formatting this story, so for readers who haven't seen it, it's set out like, I guess, how you would with a text message. So one character speaks on one side of the page and the other on the other. So it just looks like text messages. And one great thing I noticed is that the more they spoke, the more space was taken up on the page. And the less they spoke, there was more white space. And I think that's a really good metaphor for silence and speaking in a relationship, no space and less space.
Well, I think it obviously stands out in this collection, but it is also deployed very effectively, so it sticks in the reader's head. And as you mentioned, the effect of that story is best deployed via the page. But perhaps to illustrate to our listeners what the collection feels like, reads like, I understand you would like to read a selection?
This also has the longest title of all the stories. It's called A Guided Meditation for Motivation and Metamorphosis. It used to be called Long Road Becoming, and it was published in Kill Your Darlings, New Australian Fiction. I've since edited it and changed the title, and now it's its own little story. Your alarm goes off, and before the old you can hit snooze, the new you sits up and hits the stop button hard to chase any soft thoughts away. If you sleep in and don't go for a run now, you'll set yourself back and you won't be any good all day. Do this first good thing this morning and the rest of the day will be easy. Baby steps can run a marathon. You flick the lamp on and lace your running shoes up, then make your single bed, tucking everything in tightly. Soft beds breed soft men. The bed's out from the wall again, dreams having you tossing and turning. You knee the bed back flush into the corner and sniff your pillow. You peel the sweaty cover off and chuck it in the laundry on your way out. As you jog down the street, the streetlights pop off. Ahead of you, a thin slice of horizon brightens, and the black sky around it silvers, bruises, then bursts into orange flames. Now you're closer to town, and you pass all the flash houses. They emerge big and tidy and cared for in the dawning light. You wonder, for the 15th day in a row, what nice things these people have got locked up inside. And for the 15th time, you punch the thought down, leaving it for dead on the side of the road where it popped up. This is getting easier to do each day. Nobody's at the park except for a few fishermen on the jetty. You do your circuit, focusing on your arms today. Push-ups, pull-ups and burpees. Your muscles are growing powerful and hard. If you keep this up, soon you might be able to lift more than your own weight. When you're finished, your heart is pelting in your chest and your whole body is vibrating and you feel so good that no bad thoughts can get anywhere near you. This is the time you feel safest outside. You sit beneath your favourite eucalypt. Peeking out from under its peeling bark is satin-smooth wood glowing opal in the light. The skin of the river glimmers in the early sun. One of the fishermen over there catches a silver brim. He scales it quickly, divesting it of its armour. Hopefully they're all still biting when you come back down with Dad later. You'd like to stay here longer, but Terry's coming at 9. You run back home with tunnel vision, ignoring the flash houses, the burgeoning light brightening behind you as you chase your shadow, shortening slowly in front of you. As you approach your house, a bit of the old shame claws around inside your chest. The house's paint is dirty and peeling. Long flakes cling weakly to the cheap wood. But look, at least the place is neat and tidy these days without all the shit out in the front yard for everyone to see. Everything's packed up under the house now, being eaten by mold and mice. Maybe you can see if someone's got some spare paint lying around and spruce the joint up a bit. The old man would like that. Once you feel a bit stronger, you can put the feelers out. You know from last time that too much can go wrong if you start getting big ideas too soon. Wait and see how you go for a few more weeks at least. Inside the house, the mustiness hits you in the face. Maybe it's the closeness to death, the stagnation of dying. Might be the smell of cancer eating through your old man's lungs and excreting the waste, or maybe it's the smell of the residue from the radiation that's been burning through the cancer. You go check on him. He's still asleep, wheezing in and panting out. He looks so different, softer. You open up some windows to clear out his burnt-out breath, atomizing throughout the house.
Thank you for reading, Michaela. It's a very unnerving, curious story. The positive affirmations, mixed with the creeping dread, the growing understanding of this young man's situation. It all comes together very succinctly, but viscerally. And the choice of the second-person narration, I feel that adds to the effect as well.
Every time I've read a second-person story, I've found it like a guided meditation. And I just wanted to make that really explicit with the title. I thought, what if I created with this story a guided meditation so that you are really doing everything that he's doing and thinking these thoughts? I just wanted to marry up the form and the idea, and that was fun. That was fun to play with that.
Michaela, congratulations on this book, which has just come out via UQP, the University of Queensland Press, who are doing great things.
Oh, they're doing the most. They really are doing the most. I'm really proud to be in their stable, as they say.
It certainly is a fine roster of authors and of work. Michaela, thank you for taking the time to speak with me on the Readings podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much.
Always Will Be is available via all reading stores and at our website. You'll find all kinds of other recommendations for great books, music, film, and TV. You can also sign up to e-news or to receive our free monthly newsletter, The Readings Monthly. The Readings podcast is produced by me, Nico Callaghan. The show's music is by Tom Hoskins. Thank you for listening.